Great conversations start here.
Afternoons
with Kerry McIver and Mark Dye.
Call 0800 80 10 80.
News Talk ZB.
It is 2:07. Yes, afternoons with Kerry and Mark, and also Labour leader Andrew Little. Good afternoon, Andrew.
Good afternoon.
How are we?
I'm very well, thanks. Although it's raining in Auckland, this is a big surprise to me.
It is the only place in the country where you need windscreen wipers on your sunglasses, because basically the sun can be out and it will still be raining. It rains all the time. You need webbed feet here.
Unlike Wellington, which has had, 68 weeks of continuous sunshine.
I know. It does. It absolutely does.
I thought he was joking there as well.
No, the deep south is like, beautiful, beautiful sunny days, or icy cold, freezing. They're very definite about their weather. Auckland,
I lived in Auckland for 5 years, and literally for the first 3 months I was here, it rained every day. Didn't rain all day, but it rained every day for the first 3 months I was here.
Well, see, I just moved back from London, and people are always down on summers in London. But actually, I feel like it rained, case in point, right now, it rains in Auckland
quad
more.
Quad erect demonstrandum, if we look out the
window.
Yeah,
in summer than it does in London. Anyway.
So it was always a terrible thing when the only thing we've got to talk about is the weather.
We haven't. And you started it, just saying. You've had your yin and yang sorted by visiting the unions and then the EMA.
That's right.
And we've got our yin and yang sorted because we were talking to Finance Minister Bill English, and now your good self. And this was in relation to identifying the risk factors that will lead kids to very poor outcomes. Mm. I think we've known this for quite some time, or at least suspected it.
Yeah.
How is this data actually going to help families who are, in need?
The whole thing about, certainly when it comes to government and the role of the state, it's about what we do, and it's about knowing that, there are kids who are vulnerable, there are kids who are being brought up in homes that are frankly a risk to them. And, we've gone through periods over the last few decades where snatch the kids out and put them somewhere and institutionalise them, and then it said, must leave the kids and the family at all possible,
Even if the families are dysfunctional.
Even if it continues to be a risk. Mm. So we've got to find a better way of dealing with it. I don't know the answer to that, except that we know that there is still a big problem. Kids are being injured and, in fact, being killed in situations where, had we taken the right steps, then we could have prevented that. And we've got to get that right.
And it is our shame. It is we have a beautiful country, but that is the one thing I am really appalled by, is how a small minority of New Zealanders are being failed by the people who should care for them most, and indeed by the wider community.
Family violence and child abuse is this country's shame. It's our black spot. And we've got to, a lot of people know this, and we know that there is a real impetus for the political establishment and communities generally to do something about this. And, we'll all wait for the Paula Rebstock report, no doubt, and to tell us what SIFS must do or needs to do or how it will do it. But we've still got a ways to go, and we've got to find the right recipe to make this work for us.
Can governments play a significant role in reducing violence in families, or does it have to come from the ground up, from the family and communities up?
I think it's got to be a bit of both. I mean, in the end, kids are part of communities. They're in streets and suburbs and towns and cities that other people live in, so they're part of those communities. But when it comes to resources that's going to help, that provide the helping hand, provide the respite, provide the opportunity to get back on to an even keel, the state has a role to play in that as well. It's about finding that balance and finding the people, because there are some fantastic people doing some great things, but there aren't enough of them, and we've got to find a way to make sure that we meet a commitment that no child is injured, hurt, abused by those who are meant to be the closest to them.
Because it is tough policy. Like, it's really tough trying to work out what is right. Whereas saying to tertiary students, hey, we'll give you free education for 3 years, that's easy, and it looks like vote buying.
Yeah, I heard your comment, but here's the thing. 46% of jobs that exist today won't be here in 20 years' time.
Including
the
ours.
World, you may well be robots. Politicians may well be robots. Some say we already are. But the point is this, that the world of work is changing rapidly. Technology is making a radical difference to jobs. When I announced this a couple of weeks ago, I talked about what's happening with the ports of Auckland. So those big straddle carriers that carry the containers that wander all over the port, Ports of Auckland is looking at introducing driverless straddle carriers. This is what's happening. Now, they are good jobs. They're good jobs on the port, but they will go. And then what do we do with those people? So we need to make sure that both for school leavers and for people partway through their working life, that we've got something that means that they can retrain, get education, set themselves up for the beginning of their working life, for the middle of their working life, whatever it is.
Would it not be better to look at what was needed and required and fund that as opposed to just everything?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sorry if we've given the impression that it's absolutely everything. It's not. We've said, you know, we will go through line by line the courses that are on offer. We won't be funding everything.
Okay.
We won't be doing homeopathy for pets, for those who give carrots to their dog to get them better. But we will do things that are going to make sure that people get to participate, have a productive life, earn and, you know, fulfill their dreams. That's what it's got to be about.
Yeah, but that's, you know, I've done a bit of work with the First Foundation, you know, just emceeing their evenings, which is just wonderful, which takes bright, talented, motivated kids from struggling families and decile one and two schools, pairs them up, you know, puts them through university, gives them a tutor that helps them to focus, gives them a job during holidays with corporations that partner. You know, surely it's better to invest earlier to give them the motivation to succeed rather than later.
I don't think it's about either or, actually. We need an education system at the primary and secondary level that's going to do that, you know, that is giving young people the skills, the personal, emotional, psychological, intellectual skills to be resilient, to adapt, to thrive. But the reality is the nature of jobs and the skills that are going to be needed in the workplace of the future, it's no longer enough to have a good secondary education. It is almost going to be compulsory to have some post-school education and training, whether it's an apprenticeship, university, polytech, on-job training, some sort of, an updating of skills as well. The people, I guess, I'm thinking about the most, people I used to have a lot to deal with, are people, you know, they're in their 30s and 40s. Their job is going to come to an end because of technology. Mm. They've got to have access to something to give them their next chance for the remainder of their working life, and that's what this policy is about.
All right, let's get Bain out of the way quickly first. Should he be compensated?
This is going to sound like a politician's answer, but it's, you know, this
has
been...
It was the deep breath that was a giveaway of the politician's answer. Yeah.
Here's the kick for touch. This has been through so many judicial processes. I don't think you want politicians trying to cut across people who have actually sat down, seen the facts. This has been to two trials. It's had examination by people looking at compensation. But the frustration I have is this has gone on for so long. No one is going to be happy with whatever happens, and the taxpayer is continuing to foot an ongoing bill that's not achieving anything at the moment. So my view is, whatever happens, do it, cut it short, stop the bleed of the taxpayer's money, and then let's just get on with life.
Mm.
That was a politician's answer. You've evolved very well into a politician.
The training's working, you reckon?
So why is Labour not gaining any traction at all when people are getting more and more exasperated with some of the aspects of John Key's government?
I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. The last poll we had at the end of last year had us around 34-35%, from the 25% of the 2014 election. The feedback has been, I mean, since we made our policy announcement, the feedback has been overwhelming. I get around, look, I was down at the Waimumu field days in near Gore.
I know exactly where that is, thanks to our Dunedin reporter. Yep.
Excellent. Yep. So, now, admittedly, when we parked the car in the car park, the guy just parking next to me said, oh, you're in enemy country, but with a smile on his face. Mm. But we got around there, and there wasn't a person who, you know, didn't say g'day, raise an eyebrow. You know, we were very warmly received. When I get around other places, what I find is there is a growing sort of anger about just things not getting done for ordinary people, whether it's they can't get the health care, can't get the operation for mum or dad who need the hip or the knee or whatever. Concerned about the kids and the future of the kids, there's a growing exasperation, and they are talking to us about it. And
does that translate to votes?
Well, we only get to vote next year. We'll see how the polls sort of go, but the response I'm getting is very positive. And I'm enjoying life at the moment.
A texter here says, will you not concede that your bottom lines have been met with regards to the TPPA, as stamp duty acts as an effective ban on non-resident foreign buyers?
Yeah, the problem with that argument is if we can sort of put a stamp duty at 100% to get around what's in the TPPA, the question then is why have that clause in the TPPA? So the worry there is we have a clause in the TPPA, that prevents us from passing, our parliament passing a law that, you know, certainly a lot of New Zealanders say they want. Why have that clause in the TPPA? So that's the issue. And there's something else in the TPPA that I discovered that, you know, no one had alerted us to because the whole thing was done in secrecy, and that is this now this thing where not only governments, but citizens and corporates from other countries now have the right, or will have the right, to comment on our laws before we pass them. So in the same way that we open up our submission process and select committee process to New Zealand citizens when we pass a law, we now, under the TPPA, will have to open that up to the governments, citizens and corporates of 11 other countries. And I think that's wrong.
But you're not going to walk away from the agreement.
Well, it's most likely going to be ratified and concluded, assuming that the US does that, after the next election. So we won't, but what I'm signalling very clearly, as I did when I had a round of meetings in Washington, D.C. just before Christmas last year, there's stuff in it that we object to. There's genuine free trade stuff in it that's good, but there's stuff in it that's bad, and it's bad for the citizens' rights of New Zealanders, and we will object to it, and we will fight tooth and nail to get rid of it.
But isn't that the case with any agreement, especially one that involves so many parties? You have to swallow some rats. Choke them down to get your bits, you know, through.
We have never signed an agreement that puts a restriction on a type of law that Parliament could pass, nor have we signed an agreement that allows external powers and forces and influences and people to have a say on our laws through our lawmaking process. The whole reason we have a parliament and elected representatives is that they are responsible to those who elect them, not a whole bunch of people who don't live in the country. That's what's wrong.
Mm. But you aren't going to walk away from the agreement. Well, you're just going to have to swallow that rat.
No, we are. And what I signalled to the US representatives I met last year, including the most senior negotiator involved in the TPPA, is there's stuff here that if we can't change it, we will defy it and we will have that fight. But I cannot, as a politician, as a senior politician in New Zealand, say it is a good thing that we've signed up to an agreement that cuts across the democratic rights of New Zealanders, and we've got to have a fight about it.
That has the potential to cut across them.
It's there. Anybody in these 11 other countries can have a say on what laws we pass before we pass them. That opens up a whole level of influence that we've never had in New Zealand. I know the counter-argument is, but
we would have the same.
We allow external people to come now. Yeah, we do. It's entirely at our discretion. Mm. Now it's elevated to the level of an obligation. We will have an obligation to let these people have a say.
It is 25 past two with Labour leader Andrew Little now. We've got some questions for you, Andrew. First of all, Greg. Hello, Greg.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Hi, Andrew.
Good day, Greg.
Hey, really quick question. Not that I say with the TTPA, but my question is, if a corporate or an external government can have a say over legislation or proposed legislation, are we saying that they can change or block, or are we saying that they can have a say?
Yeah, they can influence. And just in the same way that, you know, New Zealand-based corporates, New Zealand citizens, not only get to write in to a select committee, but also get to lobby MPs, politicians, we now open up that whole kind of influence process, both the transparent and the hidden. That's the risk we now have got.
Okay, so if I was hiring, let's say, a pharmaceutical company today, and there was some changes in legislation occurring, my understanding is a company could still make representation through the select committee process regardless today.
Well, the select committees and MPs have a discretion about whether they allow that to happen. But the TPPA now elevates that to an obligation. We have an obligation, and there's a process spelled out in the TPPA where we go through what's called the national contact points for each country, and they have to set up a process where they notify everybody in their country about what, you know, the other countries are doing, how to make a submission, who to talk to. The whole influence process is opened up.
So, I can see the risk in that. So I suppose my secondary question would be, does that kind of agreement pose advantages for companies in New Zealand, i.e. companies wanting to have the same kind of influence in other countries around their regulation adoption?
Well, of course it means that, you know, New Zealand and New Zealand citizens and corporates can, you know, send off submissions to other countries too. We're a country of 4 million people. We are required to open up our political process to countries of, you know, 300 million people. So that's, you know, there's a huge difference.
Mm. Right. Thank you for that. We're going to move through. Thank you, Greg. Hello, Andy.
Good morning. Oh, sorry, afternoon.
That's okay.
I've got my head down, done up.
Good on you.
This TPP agreement where the governments can basically veto any legislation that we put through.
Well, they can't veto it. They can't veto it, but they now have a level of influence over it.
Can they put through submissions about their own laws they want to introduce to this country? Like mandatory vaccinations, you know, something like that?
Well, whatever legislation is going through New Zealand's Parliament, they, you know, citizens, companies, politicians from overseas get to have a say on it. Yeah, so whether it's mandatory vaccination or whatever, yes, they would.
And what about New Zealand? Does New Zealand have a say on any laws that they want to introduce in their own country?
Yeah, this, what the TPPA does is extend the processes open to New Zealand citizens to overseas.
There we go. Thank you, Andy. Hello, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Hi. My question for Andrew is, should the TPPA go through, are you committed to protecting the interests of our public broadcasters and any that exist now or in the future against possible consequences of signing the TPPA?
Yeah, I think there is an issue about public broadcasting that is bigger. You know, there's, you know, media is going through a huge amount of change at the moment, and we all want to have a strong fourth estate.
That's the spirit, Andrew.
To do, amongst other things, hold politicians to account. So we want to make sure that that's happening. So sure, I'm not sure the TPPA necessarily cuts across that, and it's a separate issue, and we are working on a public broadcasting policy as we speak.
I think they should go out there and make their own living, quite frankly. We have to. You know, we have to go to the endless valued advertisers to keep us afloat.
And you do very well. Yes. And you do very well.
That's right. Thank you very much. Didn't Andrew comment on Australian law just recently? He went over there with Phil Goff. What are other countries going to do any different?
Yeah, because we were very fortunate that there were MPs both in the Liberal Party and in the Labor Party who were keen to hear from us on that issue, because they themselves had received expressions of concern from Australian citizens and New Zealanders living over there. They had no obligation to let us in. Under the TPPA, of course, they would do.
And just finally, I think, because, Andrew, are you getting edgy about the headlines?
Well, the news is running late, but, you know.
We just have a minute. We're making the news here because you're going to say, yes, I'm going to decriminalise cannabis. Will a Labor government decriminalise cannabis and other drugs that are safer than alcohol and tobacco?
We are looking at the issue concerning cannabis for medical use, mm-hmm. because that's clearly been a current issue. And, you know, you've got to wonder whether the law at the moment is actually serving those people for whom that type of medicine can help, serving their interests. On the wider question of decriminalisation, it's an issue inside the party at the moment. One question is whether we have a referendum about it and throw it open to people to have a decide, as they did in various states in the United States.
But binding we haven't made or non-binding? A decision on that yet. Binding or non-binding referendum?
Oh, well, we're debating the question about what we do on that issue, whether we have a referendum. Haven't sort of got as far as even thinking about whether it should be binding or non-binding. I know in the various US states that considered it, I think they made them binding referendums, so Colorado, mm-hmm. Washington, mm-hmm. and what have you. Under discussion and debate inside the Labor Party at the moment.
Wait and see. That baited breath again, Kerry.
I know. My breath has been baited constantly.
Don't bait your breath, please.
All right, thank you very much for your time, Andrew.
Thank you.
Andrew Little, Labour leader.